Good afternoon, one and all. I'm Brent Holland. Welcome to today's show. This afternoon, Brian Lee Crowley, the Canadian Sentry, moving out of America's shadow. Just let me read you this very quickly about Brian Lee Crowley. Brian Lee Crowley is the author of the national bestseller, Fearful Symmetry, The Fall and Rise of Canada's Founding Values. Crowley is managing director of the MacDonald Laurier Institute for Public Policy and is a frequent commentator on political and economic issues. Now, many of you may not realize this, but amongst other things the world looks to Canada for leadership in, the world also looks our way for leadership during this current financial crisis. Brian Lee Crowley.
You probably don't recognize the extent to which Canada has carved out for itself a place in the world that is the envy of almost every other country. One of the reasons we wanted to write this book was so that Canadians, including young people who have no recollection of the struggle to balance the budget and fix the Canada pension plan and bring in free trade with the United States, so that they would understand and put that in the context of what it takes to make a great country. Because I think Canada is a great country.
This afternoon, it's Brian Lee Crowley, the Canadian Sentry, moving out of America's shadow, right now on Brent Holland. Folks, if you're just joining us today, we are speaking with Brian Lee Crowley. He's got a book out with co-authors Jason Clemens and Niels Veldhuis. Have I pronounced his last name correctly?
Niels Veldhuis.
Yeah. Veldhuis, okay. Yeah. The book is called, folks, The Canadian Sentry, Moving Out of America's Shadow. Now, just let me read this to you, folks, just real quick. 100 years ago, a great Canadian, Sir Wilfrid Laurier, predicted that the 20th century would belong to Canada. He had a plan to make it so. Laurier did indeed predict the Canadian century. He was absolutely right. He was really off by 100 years. And folks, for those of you that are listening that don't know who Sir Wilfrid Laurier is or was, he was the first Francophone PM, Prime Minister, and he was the seventh Prime Minister. He was Prime Minister from 1896 to 1911. Brian, let's jump in right away. What was it precisely that Laurier had in mind for Canada back at the turn of the last century?
Laurier presided over a period of tremendous prosperity, possibly unparalleled in the history of Canada. We had vast expansion into the West. Our cities were doubling and tripling in size over a very short period of time, tremendous economic growth. And he had kind of a formula which he thought was necessary for Canada to continue to enjoy that kind of economic prosperity. And he thought it was terribly important, given where we are in the world, that we be open to the United States, that we engage in trade with them, free trade. He thought that we had to confer advantages on ourselves. We had to have a lower tax rate, for example, than the United States, so that we could overcome some of their natural advantages. He thought we needed to have responsible public finances. We shouldn't borrow money to pay the ordinary bills. And all of these things seemed to produce great prosperity during his time. And the argument of the book is we kind of lost the Laurier plan there for the better part of the 20th century. And that's why the 20th century didn't belong to Canada. But at the end of the 20th century, we started to get back on track for the Laurier plan. And it's paid important dividends.
Two questions come to mind right away with the Laurier plan. The first one is, of course, where did we get off track from the Laurier plan? And I'm going to ask you that one first.
Sure. it was a bunch of things. Some of it was Canada getting off track. Some of it was just things going wrong that we had no control over. We didn't cause the world wars to happen. We didn't cause the depression in the 1930s. But all of those things knocked Canada off course. On the other hand, when we started to get into irresponsible public financing, vastly expanding the size of government, not being willing to tax ourselves to pay for it, so running up the debt, these were things that started in the 1960s and really hit their stride in the 70s and 80s. We only really started to fix those things in the 1990s.
Many people don't know this, but it was World War I that brought in the personal income tax. Is that correct?
Correct. 1917, I believe.
That's right. It was to pay for the war, folks, the First World War.
And it was supposed to be temporary.
Yes, rescinded right after. If anything, it's increased and gone in the opposite direction. The other question I have for you, you had mentioned the U.S. has specific strategic advantages, and I was wondering if you could just explain to our audience a few of those advantages that they have.
I think what Laurie had in mind was, you know, they've got a larger population. In many ways, they have better, less rigorous climate. They've got more access to capital. I mean, there are all sorts of ways in which the United States has some natural advantages relative to Canada. Laurie thought it was terribly important that we not wall ourselves off from the Americans because of those advantages, but instead we think creatively about how we can create advantages for ourselves that can counterbalance or offset those American advantages.
I'm just going to quote this, and this is to do with taxes. And folks, you're really going to like this quote. This quote is from the book, by the way, folks, The Canadian Century, Moving Out of America's Shadow. It's written by three Canadians. Our guest this afternoon, folks, is Brian Lee Crowley. Easy way to get the book, as always, just go to www.brenthollandshow. As always, click on that book cover. It'll take you to a place where you can pick it up and order it from the leisure of your own home. Now, let me read this quote. And folks, once again, I'm going to reiterate that this is a great quote for those of us that have been taxed to death. This is from the book. For example, studies have repeatedly shown that personal and corporate income taxes impose very high costs on society. By reducing the incentives for work, entrepreneurship, saving, and investment, which all benefit society. In other words, when countries rely on these types of taxes, they tend to get less work effort, entrepreneurship, savings, and investment than they otherwise would, which results in a less prosperous country. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because I think you've hit on a subject there that is very dear to most Canadians' hearts, and that is the amount of tax we pay.
What we're saying in that particular passage is it matters tremendously how you tax people as well as how much you tax them. The income tax is the more you work and the more income you earn, the more tax you pay. It's not just more in absolute terms. They start to take a bigger and bigger share of what you're earning. What that does is it gives people less reason to work as hard as they might. People might say, well, rather than working really hard and letting the tax man take 40 or 45% of my earnings, why could work less hard, maybe take more time off, have more leisure. These are problems that all kinds of societies face when their tax burden gets out of hand. You end up, in effect, discouraging people from working as hard as they might if they were able to capture most of the benefit of working for themselves.
We have a lot of social programs. Healthcare comes to mind. How can we pay for these great social programs with the amount of taxes we're paying right now? In other words, taxes are too high, but yet we want the benefits of this great social network that we have. How do we come to balance the two?
Yeah, and I think the social safety net that we have in Canada is something that Canadians are justifiably proud of. One of the things we point out in the book is that there are really three great entitlement programs. There's the Canada Pension Plan for retirees. There's social welfare for people who can't make enough money in the workplace in order to support themselves. And there's the health care program, Medicare. Now, we point out in the book that two of those programs we reformed fundamentally during the great decade of reforms that put us back on track for the Laurier Plan. We fixed the Canada Pension Plan, which was heading into essentially into insolvency, in which the chief actuary of the Canada Pension Plan now says that it's solvent for the next 75 years, a huge turnaround, which is very hard to achieve in democratic society. Just look at the United States and the trouble they have with Social Security reform. So that's number one. We were able to fix that, and it's a great Canadian achievement. Second, social welfare. Right across Canada, we reformed social welfare during the 1990s, and we were able to spend less money on social welfare while still providing adequate support for people who can't earn enough money in the workplace. And so another huge, I think, Canadian reform victory. The one that we haven't tackled yet in any serious way, in my view, remains healthcare. And when I say we still have to reform it, I'm not in any way suggesting we want to get rid of what Canadians are so proud of, which is a healthcare system that ensures that nobody is economically damaged by falling sick. We have a universal plan. All these are good things. But there are many, many ways to organize and pay for a healthcare system like that. And I think it's pretty clear that Canadians are not getting good value for the money that they're spending on the healthcare system when we compare it to other countries that are getting better bang for the buck. So we still have some work ahead of us.
Folks, the book is called The Canadian Century, Moving Out of America's Shadow. And we're going to be talking about America's shadow in just a few seconds. The author of the book and our guest today, Brian Lee Crowley. Brian Lee Crowley, just let me read this from the back of the book. Just a little bit about his bio. That he is an authority. He is the author of the national bestseller Fearful Symmetry, The Fall and Rise of Canada's Founding Values. Crowley is managing director of the Macdonald Laurier Institute for Public Policy and is a frequent commentator on political and economic issues for the CBC, Radio-Canada, and many other media. It's a global economic situation in the world right now. How do we move out from underneath the so-called U.S. shadow? You see, I always looked at it this way, Brian. We have a much, much smaller population, therefore a smaller market, 33 million people as opposed to 330 million people. Just most people live within a couple of hundred kilometers of the border, just to the south of that border. There's a huge, huge market available to us. So if you sell to 1% up here, you're selling to a relatively small number of people. If you sell to 1% into the States, which is just down there, 200 kilometers away, you're selling to a heck of a lot more people. How do we justify going overseas and looking for markets over there when the logistics of selling over there are so difficult?
First of all, I don't want to leave people with the impression that we're saying we should abandon the great success we've enjoyed in the United States. On the contrary, part of what we're trying to say in the book is that traditionally Canada has been in this great North American partnership between Canada and the United States. We've always been kind of the poor cousin. You know, America is so big and so powerful, and, you know, you always sort of feel like you're in their shadow. What we were trying to say is that actually we have created, through some of the great reforms that I've talked about, we have created a comparative advantage for Canada, which means that Canada is becoming more attractive than the United States as a place to create businesses, to employ people, as a place to immigrate. Therefore, it's not that we're going to abandon our relationship with the United States, but rather we are going to become the stronger partner in terms of the economic fundamentals. We're never going to be bigger than the United States. That's not the issue. You know, the wealthiest societies in the world, in my view, are the little societies, the little countries on the edge of economic behemoths. Think about Holland on the edge of Germany or Switzerland, or think about Taiwan, or think about Singapore. These places are immensely wealthier than their neighbors, but they depend on the relationship they have with the neighbors and their big markets and so on. So it's not that I think that Canada is going to become immensely wealthier than the United States, but I think after 30 or 40 years of falling behind, I think we're going to go through a period in which we're going to catch up, and I don't think it's at all beyond imagining that we might even overtake the United States in terms of our standard of living. I think that's within our grasp.
I think we have a very high standard of living, considering the geographic. It's a huge country. The logistics of getting stuff from one end of the country to the other is just phenomenal. Let's continue along with some of these thoughts. You're talking about decentralization, the key to getting more from less. Of course, the healthcare. Let's go back to that a little bit and spend a little bit of time on healthcare. You had mentioned as part of your policy advising that we have to revamp healthcare. How would you go about doing that? I'm just going to use this as an example, just to guide us through one of the things that we have to tackle. How would we go about doing that?
In the book, we draw some inspiration from the success we enjoyed in reforming social welfare. We point out that when we reformed welfare in the 1990s, it wasn't Ottawa sort of telling the provinces what to do and how to run their welfare system. On the contrary, that's what Ottawa had been doing for years, and it had created an expensive and poorly thought out and poorly organized system, because the provinces could just pass a lot of the cost of their social welfare off onto Ottawa. So what Ottawa did as part of fixing their fiscal problems was they said, look, you guys can't just send us the bill anymore. What we're going to do is we're going to say, you're actually going to get less money than you've been getting, because Ottawa has been transferring money for social welfare for years. We're going to give you less money, but in exchange for you accepting less money, we're going to give you freedom to organize your social welfare policies the way you think best for your local circumstances. And that resulted in just an explosion of experimentation across the country as different provinces tried to tailor their welfare programs to their specific circumstances. And you got some provinces that brought in workfare and other provinces that brought in residency requirements, all kinds of things. That had a tremendously beneficial effect on the welfare system in the country and saved us a lot of money. So the lesson that we draw from that in the book is to say that, you know, Ottawa is really not, in our view, in a position to know the best way to organize a healthcare system in Nova Scotia as opposed to Alberta or the Northwest Territories. It's the provincial governments that actually have to deliver those services that are closest to the people and know best what will work for their local population. So we're suggesting that Ottawa should cap its transfers to the provinces just as they did on social welfare, but give the provinces much more latitude to experiment with different kinds of reforms, which might include making more use of private clinics, more public-private partnerships, perhaps what they're doing in Quebec with charging people something on their income tax for using the healthcare system. All of these things should be permitted as experiments to find out what's going to work best for Canadians.
I don't want to be an antagonist here. Folks, I just want to let you know who our author guest is today. His name is Brian Lee Crowley. He's got a great book out called The Canadian Century, Moving Out of America's Shadow. Easy way to get it, as always, www.brenthollandshow.com. Click on the book cover, take you somewhere where you can order it online. Brian, I don't want to be an antagonist, but you brought up Quebec. Several years ago, $800,000 was given to Premier Charest, supposed to be for health care. He didn't use that money for health care. How do we enforce the provinces, if there's no centralized law per se, how do we enforce the provinces to act in good faith with the money that they're allotted from other Canadian taxpayers? Such as in the case of Quebec.
I assume you're talking about the extra money that was given under the so-called fiscal imbalance.
Exactly. Yes, sir.
This was money that went to Quebec for the provision of provincial services, and they turned around and said, well, actually, we'd prefer to cut our taxes with this money.
That's correct.
This is a problem that's always existed. I mean, there's all kinds of money that flows to the provinces for equalization and the Canadian health transfer and the Canadian social transfer. It's very hard to get the provinces to toe much of a policy line. I think the issue is to give the provinces more autonomy and then ask their electorates, you know, the voters who vote for those provinces, to hold their governments accountable. Now, I personally would rather see the government transferring less money and instead give more tax room, you know, like just as an example, transfer the GST to the provinces, just give it to the provinces and then say no more transfers from Ottawa. And that way, you know, when Quebec spends money, they have to raise it from their local taxpayers by taxes that those taxpayers can see and politicians are answerable for. I actually think it creates all kinds of, it breaks the democratic accountability loop, if I can call it that way, when Ottawa taxes and then gives the money to the provinces to spend on social services, because then the taxpayer in, say, Quebec is getting benefits from the province, but only paying part of the bill because part of the bill has been paid by people in Alberta and Newfoundland. I think it's far better in each province for provinces to have to raise the money they're spending from local taxpayers and then be accountable for the decisions they make.
But what about a central government? Would there not be then a need for a central government and one perspective?
Absolutely. No. We're only talking about the services that provinces provide. There's all kinds of things that only Ottawa can do. I mean, Ottawa has the job of providing national defense, national security, foreign affairs, Aboriginal affairs, managing a lot of the immigration, national economic management. There's 1,000 things that Ottawa does and needs to do well. I happen to think that administering social programs isn't one of them that it does very well.
Our guest today is Brian Lee Crowley. The book, The Canadian Century, Moving Out of America's Shadow. You can get it very easily just by going to the www.brenthollandshow.com website. Just click on the book cover. We'll take you to a spot where you can order it online. One of the subjects you touched on, which is very dear to my heart, is entrepreneurship, because I have a small business. We get shafted left, right, and center. Can we talk a little bit about some proposals to lessen the tax burden for those of us that are self-employed and want to hire employees. Very often, I'll see somebody who's working in a union making zillions of dollars, more than what I'll ever see, and on top of that has no social responsibility whatsoever. I mean, everything is taken care of for him or her. How can we make it more advantageous and more attractive for people to go into business for themselves? Because as we all know, the backbone of the country is small business.
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with that. And there's no doubt that when we let public finances, for instance, get out of control, we let the tax burden rip, we were borrowing all this money, which is simply deferred taxes. So when a government borrows a dollar, it's just a dollar in taxes they haven't charged you yet. Mm-hmm. All of these things, I think, put tremendous pressure on the business community, both large and small. And one of the reasons that Laurier and his plan, and the plan that we sing the praises of in the Canadian Century, you know, he said, look, we just have to keep tax burden below the tax burden in the United States, because that's how we have our competitive advantage. And of course, when we did that, as we started to ease the tax burden down over the course of the first decade of the 21st century, we're now heading to a business tax rate that's below that of the United States and so on, we started to recover a lot of the economic dynamism that Laurier thought was characterized Canada. So I think that Laurier's plan is one that speaks exactly to the issue that you raise about the future of small business.
Yeah, I would like to see more high-tech stuff come into play in Canada. I think for far too long we have been relegated just to the, like mining, for example, just the raw elements, and we just send those out unfinished, and I would like to see more high-tech. I think we're capable of much more in this country. I think somewhat we're complacent, and that bothers me a lot.
Well, complacency is exactly one of the things that we warn against in the book, because mm-hmm. we have enjoyed, I think, tremendous success. Just look at how well we weathered the recession, how sound our financial institutions are, you know, all of these things, the employment growth we enjoyed prior to the recession. All of these things are, I think, evidence of Canada's underlying strength, but I think there's also lots of evidence that we're starting to backslide, that we're starting to get complacent, that we think that somehow the good things that we've enjoyed over the last few years are somehow simply foreordained, and I don't think they are. They're something we have to work at, and if we allow ourselves to slip back into deficit on a permanent basis, let our public finances get out of control, I think we will simply go back to the economic doldrums that we inhabited for far too long.
One of the things you touched on in the book, and folks, by the way, the book is called The Canadian Century, Moving Out of America's Shadow. Our guest today is Brian Lee Crowley. He's one of three authors, is infrastructure. You were saying that we should have put money into infrastructure in order to become more efficient for the movement of goods. And as I traveled from Sudbury to Montreal on the goddamn Trans-Canada, and notice how I preface that, this is not the 401, folks. This is an archaic highway. It's a two-lane highway with constant traffic everywhere. You go from 60 kilometers an hour up to about 100. What should be a 5.5 hour journey between Sudbury to Montreal turns into 7.5, because when the highway was designed in its originality, it was designed to connect communities, which is a noble cause in 1948 when there was 5 cars in the whole country. Now we are spending millions by forcing big trucks every day to go through these small little towns of, I don't know, maybe 1,000 people to slow down to 60 kilometers, 50 kilometers an hour, and then they have to get back up to speed again. The amount of energy, the amount of time lost, the amount of petroleum used for this is astronomical. Is this a good time to be building infrastructure?
One of the things that Laurier did, and one of the lessons we drew from his great experience was, he said, look, good infrastructure is often something that only government can do, or government in partnership with people who have capital. This is one of the fundamental roles of government, is to make sure that these common goods, like the roads, the sewers, the water, you know, all this basic infrastructure, this is partly a responsibility of government. And if we allow those things to deteriorate, government is not playing its key role. I think the lesson we learned from the 70s and 80s was that government can easily be diverted from that central role of building and maintaining high-quality infrastructure, because it's actually politically kind of attractive to spend that money on sending checks to people through various kinds of social programs. But actually, if nobody else can build and maintain that crucial infrastructure, then that means that job doesn't get done. I think that one of the things that Laurier spent most of his time doing was building this country by building good quality infrastructure and making sure that it was responsibly paid for. We have a lot to learn from him.
I agree 110%. It would also give people in construction work and all the spin-offs thereof. I think this is a prime example of, we've got to start building this country again, going back to the complacency thing and the apathy I've seen. We've got to start moving forward again and become a leader where we have been, and in so many areas that we haven't been, we can be. I think this is a great time. I think it's a great book, folks. I urge you all to go out and give it a good read. There's some good ideas, solid ideas in this book. The Canadian Century, Moving Out of America's Shadow. Our guest and author, Brian Lee Crowley, today. Brian, we're going to have to start to wrap up now, but I'm going to ask you a question I virtually ask every guest who comes on the show. And that question is, this show's demographic is every university student from coast to coast to coast, and international students as well. What would you say to them?
Well, I'd say, especially to Canadian students, if you're like other Canadians, you probably don't recognize the extent to which Canada has carved out for itself a place in the world that is the envy of almost every other country. One of the reasons we wanted to write this book was so that Canadians, including young people who have no recollection of the struggle to balance the budget and fix the Canada pension plan and bring in free trade with the United States, so that they would understand and put that in the context of what it takes to make a great country. Because I think Canada is a great country. I think we backslid a little bit for a number of years, but we were able, through discipline and responsible politics and the leadership of our entire political class, we were able to fix many of those problems in a way that, you know, when you look at Europe and all the difficulty they're going through right now in Greece and Spain and places like that, or you look at the United States where they're stuck with unreformed Social Security and healthcare financing problems and so on, and you look at Canada, and you really should feel that Canada is a place that we are deservedly proud of these days, but we mustn't take the great things we've accomplished here for granted.
I think that's a perfect way to end it. And as I always like to say, is if we can take that work ethic that we all have in hockey and transpose that over to everyday life, no one would touch us, as in
exactly. Hockey. Elbows up.
There you go. And the Habs will win next year, guaranteed. All I can say, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Brent, it was great to talk to you, and thanks so much for calling.
Thank you, my friend, and all the best.
Bye-bye.
I sincerely want to thank our guest today, Brian Lee Crowley, for coming on the show. Coming up on Brent Holland. Get ready for this, folks. This is a not-to-be-missed show. Jonestown, November 18th. 1978. That's the night Jim Jones, leader of the People's Temple, murdered 909 U.S. citizens in the middle of the jungle in Guyana. Our guest, Mark Lane, was there. He is a living witness, barely. He was supposed to have been assassinated that night at gunpoint. Instead, he was able to flee to the jungle, but not before he heard those horrendous sounds of the children crying as they drank that Kool-Aid. Mark Lane.
Guards come up and say, you're both under revolutionary arrest and you'll be executed. And they took us to a cabin. And by then, they started killing people up there. I was only about 200 yards away. And the cabin, I heard, they broadcast it all on a microphone saying, we all have to die. It's revolutionary suicide. People were screaming, you know. They were forced to drink poison. Some were shot. So they tried to leave. And I heard all of that. And then these two guys said, we're all going to die. Come on out, Mark.
As always, you can reach me at brenthollandshow@gmail.com. Don't forget, folks, if you're doing research on real-life history, www.brenthollandshow.com. There you will find a plethora, a wealth of shows in the archives for you to research. Living history. That's what this show is all about. Having people who went through those historical traumatic times, like our guest next time, Mark Lane at Jonestown. In their own words, they tell their stories. Quote them directly. I'm Brent Holland. Thank you all for listening. See you next time.
Yeah.